Oh, hi. This is Cindy Howes from Basic Folk, and here's what's happening on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. Only Vans, a Texas country music pod with rock star host Bree Bagwell, recently welcomed Matt Hillier.
You sang a song nobody had ever heard, and you kept going, come on, everybody, sing it with me.
You know the words.
You know the words. It was the best.
On Basic Folk, honest conversations with folk musicians, myself and co-host Lizzie Noh recently featured John Moreland.
Some of the lyrics are like, you seem to know some things you must have overheard. It sounds like it's talking about a lover. A couple minutes into the song, he's talking about a smartphone, and it just creeped me out so hard that I got a flip phone too.
Oh, wow. And finally, the String Dusters' Travis Book is hosting the Travis Book Happy Hour, live music and conversation from guests like Trey Hensley.
Just listening to Earl Scruggs play the banjo or play the guitar, you always knew it was him. There was always those people that played, and you immediately, within a few seconds of hearing their instrument, knew it was them.
Hear it all and more on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts. Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians and summer allergies. I'm your host, Cindy Howes, here with Lizzie Noh.
Hi, Cindy. Achoo, achoo.
Great. That's been my life recently.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's going okay because I've discovered allergy pills. You take them.
I love to take allergy pills. I took one not 30 minutes ago. And the reason? Because I'm around a dog that I'm allergic to.
Of course. No one is surprised.
I'm allergic to all dogs. And I also need to kiss all dogs on the face.
Basic focus on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. We are so happy to be there. Heart, heart, heart. Lilas, Lilas, Lilas.
Lilas. We love BGS. These are good people.
Very.
Speaking of BGS, I had my first like write down things on paper journalism assignment thanks to the Bluegrass Situation. They hired me to write a feature on Swamp Dog and his new album. And yes, I'm plugging other work of mine on the podcast, but maybe I can just tie it in because it's also for the Bluegrass Situation. And I don't know if you guys know about Swamp Dog, his life, his story, his like bajillion producer credits, but he's so funny and cool and inspiring. And we had such a good conversation. So go read my essay on Swamp Dog.
We are a podcast and we have an email list. We send out an email once a month-ish. We'll let you know who's been on the podcast, who's coming up, and thoughts and feelings about everything. You can follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. We're on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. You can also make a financial contribution to Basic Folk so that we can make this podcast and that I don't go into bankruptcy.
I would love for Cindy to not go into bankruptcy or for the show to go into bankruptcy. So everyone, do with that hope what you will.
Yes, you can support us because sometimes when you don't support things that you like, they go away and they get canceled.
And if you do support them, then they start to do amazing things that you never thought possible.
Right. So if you'd like to support this podcast, you can check out the link in the show notes. That's where you can donate. That's also where you can sign up for the newsletter or go to basicfolk.com.
Cindy, we're going into August. What's like, it's so cool when we record these episodes and then they come out in the future. Like right now, we're just at the beginning of July. Right. And who do you think you're going to be by the time this episode comes out?
That's a very good question. I do plan on, during the month of July, attending the Howes family reunion.
Oh my gosh.
I'm also going on a trip with my high school besties to Canada. And I look forward to being able to swim in the ocean in Maine, which I have heard you can do in August.
But it's so cold.
Honestly, Lizzie, I went into the ocean water yesterday, the final day of the month of June when we were actually recording this. And all I could think of was hypothermia.
I mean, I am a real ocean gal, but that is not my vibe.
Yeah.
By the time this podcast comes out, breaking news, I will be an auntie. Think about that. Even now, as we speak, my sister is awaiting the birth of my nephew.
What do you think he's going to be like?
What is he going to be like? So I think about this a lot, and part of me wonders, like, what are his hobbies going to be? And do I have enough time to, like, get well-versed in those hobbies so that when he comes to me wanting to share his love of, like, tennis or watercolor painting, mm-hmm. like, will I be ready to support him as an aunt should? What if he goes into computer coding? Or what if he wants to do, like, leather tanning?
Mm.
Or what if he wants to be an astronaut? Like, there's just so – there's so many possibilities, and I don't know if I have time to get well-versed in every possible dream he could have, but I'm sure going to try.
But maybe he'll be interested in the harp and napping.
Oh, that would be incredible. If he's interested in the harp, napping, dogs, and bridges and other infrastructure, I'm good to go, dude.
Yeah. Lizzie, I feel like I'm dying. So would you want to talk about this, the episode that we have today on Basic Folk? We're talking to John Smith.
Oh, thank God. Okay. We love John Smith on this podcast. John Smith is a friend of mine and a friend of the pod. We just went on tour together this past April. And so I always love the episodes where I get to interview someone whose live show I've seen like 20 times. Here's a real intro that doesn't just say like, this is my buddy. Let's talk about him. Let's talk about John Smith as the dope and important artist that he is. English singer-songwriter John Smith got his start playing bars and clubs in Liverpool, both playing his own music and as a sideman for artists like Leon Le Havas. Ooh la la. John's sensitivity as a guitar player is one of the cornerstones of his music and has earned him a passionate fan base ever since his first EP release in 2009. Now, I got to witness the connection that he shares with his audiences on a recent month-long tour all around the UK. Everywhere we went, audience members had stories of how important John's songs were to them, and guitar nerds would flock to the stage after the show to get a look at his pedal board. But beyond his musicianship, John's music is imbued with an earnestness that invites listeners to look around and feel gratitude. Gratitude for nature, especially the vistas of rural England, gratitude for the wisdom that memory can provide, and gratitude for the people that are close to us. John's latest album, The Living Kind, is a meditation on how delicate love and life can both be, but also how enduring. The album showcases the creative partnership between Smith and his longtime friend and producer, Joe Henry. One of the album's highlights for me is Milestones, a really sweet song in which John reflects on how being a parent has changed his perspective on the artist's journey. Everyone, go listen to The Living Kind. John is my label mate. He is a guitar playing, songwriting hero of mine, and he's also a really good and funny dude.
Let's listen to the title track from John's new album, The Living Kind, and then we'll get to our conversation between Lizzie and John Smith on Basic Folk.
Get up, get dressed, and face the day. What do you know? What do you say? Hide it all behind the fear. Taking it slow, counting the years. I don't feel like running out of time. The night just falls behind, yeah. Someone sliding away, I'm watching them fade, finally dreaming of a plan. Do what you must, do what you can. I don't feel like running out of time. The night turns into days, yeah. Someone to find me out of my own way, yeah. Someone to find me.
John Smith.
Hiya.
Welcome.
Hello, hello. It's nice to see you.
We have no time for small talk. I have a lot of questions to ask you.
Oh, okay. I want to know about your Uber ride to the airport, though. So I'm going to have to hold all this in.
I don't have any memory of that.
Okay.
I don't remember anything that's happened to me in my life, including the month-long tour that we just did together. No memories.
Okay, fair enough.
But speaking of memories, you, John Smith, grew up in Devon, which is an area of southwest England. What was it like to grow up there and to be a young artist there? Huh. And what were your early experiences of seeing live music?
Well, I grew up in a small and quite insular fishing town. My dad moved us down there when he was doing really well in the record business. He was distributing classical records. So he took the bold decision to move out of London, buy a big house by the sea, and move 200 miles west, which he did. And then soon after lost the business, got screwed over in a very sort of classic handshake record industry deal. Went bankrupt overnight and found himself unemployed for a long time. So I grew up in a house that was full of music and yet also sort of full of the stress of working in the music business. So I sort of early on had an idea of, you know, okay, if I'm going to go in the music business, got to be careful. The town itself was totally gorgeous. I mean, you know, the south coast of England is beautiful. And it just happened to be quite a working class fishing town, quite rough. So the fishermen were coming off the boats. They would beat their wives and sons. And then the sons would come out on the streets and beat up kids like me who were, you know, sitting around smoking cigarettes and talking about music.
Oh my God.
So we spent a lot of time running away from those lads and hiding, hiding in my room and playing guitar.
So what do you think that did to your sense of what it meant to be like a musician? Did you form an identity kind of in opposition to your surroundings in a way?
Perhaps. Well, my brother had already done that for me. So I've got a brother who's 9 years older, and he was a hardcore goth and was walking around town in a leather jacket with, occasionally with mascara. He has jet black hair. And so he had kind of paved the way. And I decided that the music I liked was guitar music. So I formed my identity, but it was nowhere near as extreme as his. And so I was sort of in his shadow quite a bit. It was him who first turned me on to Nick Drake and, you know, so much good music that I love and that kind of influenced me very early on and made me realize I wanted to be a musician.
Yeah, I was going to ask you specifically, like, can you talk about your introduction specifically to folk music and like what were the early things about folk music and singer-songwriter records that kind of turned on a light bulb in your mind? What do you think it was about that type of music that captured your attention?
I think it was the intimacy of the guitar and vocal. And I found my way into folk through the blues. My dad was really into Clapton and Muddy Waters. And he around the time that I was maybe 11, 12, I picked up a guitar for the first time. And I was just really into Clapton and Hendrix and B.B. King. And my mum would play a lot of Joni Mitchell and Maria Callas, all of these forms of music that are essentially folk music, but, you know, not the sort of hardcore trad folk that I discovered later.
Right.
So it was really just the expression of one person into a microphone that I found completely captivating. And it was actually the Eric Clapton Unplugged record that was doing big business. And my dad bought me the tablature book. And I just sat in my room and I learned all those songs. Hearing people play the blues into, you know, acoustic instruments, you could see the video and you could see that they were just playing into microphones and they were making this sound. And that was kind of my way in, quite a mainstream introduction to what it was just to gather around and play instruments in front of microphones. And that was it. I was kind of hooked. Later on, my brother, when I was 17, he sat me down and said, right, stop messing around, listen to this. And we smoked and we listened to Five Leaves Left by Nick Drake. And that,
oh my God,
the doors just went, when I was in a different world completely. And that world has been my home ever since, I think. I'm just utterly captivated by the space between the six strings of a guitar and a voice and everything that can be produced there.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mention both Nick Drake and Maria Callas, because it to me, it kind of, having seen your show now like 20 times, that those artists kind of bridge the gap between like the guitar player, singer-songwriter vibe and the very like almost mystical physicality of like people who are like singers. Mm. It seems like you kind of have influence of both ends of that part of the singer-songwriter spectrum, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Lofty heights, but yeah.
Yeah, it's always fun to interview someone after I've seen their show a bunch of times, because like I hone in on things that I'm curious about and then we get to dig into it. I'm kind of curious about another like aspect of your musical like training and work, which is that you have spent a lot of time as a sideman. Mm. Like, I mean, you had your early days as a singer-songwriter in Liverpool playing bars and clubs, and you also like had quite a bit of success like being a guitar player in other people's bands, like for Leanne LaHavis and others. Mm-hmm. So how would you describe your character as a sideman? Like if you were to like, when you were getting jobs, how would you describe yourself as like, this is the type of guitar player I am? And do you feel like it's kind of like a different type of musician than you are as a solo artist, if that makes sense?
Gosh, yeah. I think it's all part of the same approach, which is to offer yourself in service of the song. Mm-hmm. But it's much more on the nose when you're in service of someone else's song. And you have to take a step back, you know, to the side. You are a side man, side person. And so your job is to find a place within their puzzle and make them sound good, you know, and make the song sound good. So you learn a certain amount of humility. You know, keeps your ego in check, which is really useful. You know, it's sort of, you learn a lot from standing behind somebody who is incredibly good at what they do. And when I was playing with David Gray, there was a moment where he was sort of holding 10,000 people in the palm of his hand, and I was playing some guitar lines, and I was just thinking, I'm part of something that's way bigger than me, way bigger than him, way bigger than the rest of the band and the crowd. You know, it was like we were in the slipstream, you know, that great slipstream of live music. And so when I come out of that and move into my own thing, I sort of think, okay, sometimes I find myself thinking, what would Lisa Hannigan do right now? She'd probably put the guitar down and just sing a cappella. So I've done that a few times, having learned that trick from Lisa, because it's such a potent, powerful trick, especially if you sound like her. But nevertheless, people like it when you put an instrument down and just sing, you know. So I remember talking to Joe Henry about it when I got kicked out of Leanne's band. I remember thinking, well, what's going to happen now? I was broke and we just had my daughter. I was a long way from making a new record in my head. I remember saying to Joe Henry, like, what the hell do I do? And he said, take the tools that are in your toolbox and go and build something. And I thought, okay, that's it. That is session work. You are given tools and you get to sharpen those tools. And then if you're fortunate, you get to go and make something else with those tools.
Are there parts of your ego that you've had to consciously like rebuild to be able to like do the solo, I'm the front person thing? Like, is there a mental shift for you going back into like being the front person?
Yeah, I have to psych myself up quite a bit. But I think I've mellowed since sort of just before COVID, I was starting to burn out. And since then, I don't take it quite as seriously. So I think maybe... Mm-hmm. Maybe I was just quite a typical angry young man with a lot to prove and got myself into a few scrapes, unfortunately, because of I was carrying whatever weight was associated with that.
Right.
Being a session right hand, you know, guitar person sort of knocked a lot of that out of me, because it, you realize actually the world doesn't revolve around you. And then when you go out on stage, you have to sort of, as you know, you have to sort of project a certain amount of front so that, because you want people to take you seriously, you want people to look at you in a certain way, whatever. I found that actually letting go of a lot of that and going on stage more and just sort of being more myself has been really liberating. I'm quite a quiet person instinctively. I like to be loud and have a laugh, but I generally am a fairly quiet, reserved person. So if I can go on stage and give vent to a side of myself that doesn't get too much of an airing, the sort of, you know, oh, look at me, where aren't we having fun? And then as soon as I come off stage, I just want to sleep, you know, I'm drained. So I find this is a long-winded way around your question, but I think essentially the ego's been maybe beaten out of me by experience a bit, and now I'm really conscious on just trying to be myself on stage, you know, without too much look at me.
Speaking of that COVID era, like, shift, I think it happened for a lot of artists where we had to rethink what is this work that we're doing and what does success look like. You put out a great record in the midst of the pandemic called The Fray, and it's a record that has some great duets and it's very collaborative. I mean, the Milk Carton Kids, Sarah Jarosz, Lisa Hannigan, but you kind of can't hear that record without hearing the context of, like it was created in a little bit more of an isolated circumstance than maybe previous records or other records. So what did making and releasing The Fray during COVID teach you about your musical community and like what collaboration was like?
Well, I learned about long distance collaboration. And at the time that we recorded it, Sam Lakeman and I, who was co-producing the record, we thought that we had come up with this brilliant idea. Let's get our friends in America and Ireland to record at home and send us the audio. No one else is doing this. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Of course, by the time the record comes out, everyone's done it. Turns out Joe Henry and Aoife were making a record of exactly that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so exciting because then you get all this audio back from people you love and admire, and it's as though they are in the room with you when you play it back. They're pushing you on. I tell a story on stage sometimes about Sarah Jarosz in particular, because she sent me the audio overnight. I went in to the studio at 7 a.m. We got it off Dropbox, put the WAV on the screen, you know, into the session, listened to it. And I went, bloody hell, I'm going to have to sing my bit again.
I've been there.
blown me out of the water. And it was great because, you know, when someone like that's in the studio, you do your top button up and you square your shoulders and you give it everything you got. So I thought, okay, right, I need to try harder. And that was brilliant, especially as well when Bill Frisell sent his parts in. He sent in 7 different takes and I had this incredible evening just listening to Bill, my favourite guitar player. And I ended up writing to him saying, Bill, this is brilliant, but reckon you could maybe send a couple more. Like a couple of slower ones.
It's like, how do you narrow down all those takes?
We couldn't, man. And so I just asked him to play a little slower and he did. And then we used a bit of that as an intro and a bit of another take and we played along to it. And it was like he was in the room. So that was a joy. But it also taught me that releasing a record in an isolated, in the sort of bubble of COVID was financially perilous and something it was something of a risk, you know, but I think it's all worked out. I'm happy with the record.
Yeah, it's a great record. And like, what, okay, how did you mentally go into re-recording it as The Fray Variations? Like, what were some of your goals with the changed arrangements? Like, can you talk about, like, what did you want audiences to hear on The Fray Variations that they might not have heard on the original studio recordings?
Well, the truth is that my friend Stephen Price, who is a brilliant arranger for film and TV, he won the Oscar for Gravity and has scored a bunch of films. He's wonderful. He wrote string arrangements. He wrote some of those arrangements for the album. But then as the studio session was unfolding, Jason Rebello, the pianist, came in to play on a few songs, and his playing kind of changed the direction of everything. And I realized that this was going to be a less cinematic record and something a little more intimate, sort of like I had in mind an early Van Morrison record. And then the musicians in the room dictated the flow of the record, and I had these string arrangements which really weren't done enough justice in the main session. So a few months later, I went down to Abbey Road, and actually we used the bones of the original tracks, guitar and vocals, and I played a couple. Mm-hmm. I re-recorded a couple of them live with the strings, but I just let Stephen arrange his string quartet over the bones of the songs that made the main record.
Oh, interesting. So had those been recorded to a click track, or did you do them live? So you did like live guitar and vocals, or did you have like a scratch guitar to a click?
It all happened very quickly. I cut all the guitars and vocals in the first 2 days to a click.
Okay, cool.
To a click, because the way we had to structure personnel coming and going was very rigid, because you were only allowed 4 people in there at once.
Oh, wow.
I think, or 5. So I cut it to a click, and then the drummer came in on the 4th day. The bass player came in on the 2nd day, horns on the 3rd, and so on.
Whoa.
So yeah, we did cut it to a click, and then that was a lot easier for the meat for the strings to latch mm-hmm. onto. I think I cut the vocal separately. I cut all the guitars first, then the vocal. So that's a really clean way to make records, which is why I was sort of, it was liberating doing the complete opposite for the next record. Mm-hmm. But on that record, we recorded in Real World as well, which is an amazing space. So you kind of want every individual element to sound as good as it can. So Sam was adamant, let's record the vocal separately.
That's super interesting. Now, I mean, it's going to be a contrast when we talk about The Living Kind, which is your new record, which just came out on 30 Tigers. Mm. Before we get into some of the songs on The Living Kind, can you tell me about your friendship with Joe Henry? Like, how did you build up a collaborative rapport, and what was pre-production like on The Living Kind with Joe?
Well, I've known Joe since 2011. I met him on the session for Lisa Hannigan's record Passenger, and we were friends from the moment we met, and we've been good friends ever since. He's been like a big brother to me and a mentor, and I've played on various productions of his, including 4 of his own records, so I'm used to having a really tight-knit relationship with him. And when we get in the studio, he's very encouraging. He tells me roughly what he wants, but he's a very subtle person. He puts people in the pool, doesn't tell them where to swim, he just puts them all in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
So pre-production was basically a series of phone calls and me sending him demos and saying, what do you think? And him saying, yeah, I think this is good. I think we should record it. Or this one, I'm not so sure. You know, I don't know. Don't know about this one. What do you think? And that means, yeah, he doesn't dig it.
Was there ever a time when he didn't dig something, but you like put your foot down and you were like, no, I want to see where it goes? Because I know I get really like sensitive with feedback. And if anyone, like, even if they're smiling really big, but maybe there's like a little bit of a shadow, I'm like, oh, they must hate it. I'm going to quit music.
No, it was...
The album is trashed.
I know that feeling. I know that feeling very well. That happens to me with shows. Like, if something derails a show, I get totally dispirited. But with songs in their early sort of the embryonic stage of a song, it's kind of all open mm-hmm. to discussion. And I said to Joe about both Dividing Line and Trick of the Light, I don't think this is good. You know, let's skip this one. And those were the two we recorded first. And those are my two favourites probably off the record. So I was very, basically, because he was producing, I just handed him the reins. I sort of left my opinions at the door to a certain extent. So if he said, no, this one, we are going to record this one, then I just went with it. And there was nothing where I said, I want this one, and he said, no, let's not do that one, because he wouldn't. He sort of I think he respects...
Right, you're the artist.
Yeah, and he respects that enough to... I mean, I'm sure if there had been a song that he disagreed on, he'd have let me record it and then listen back and go, oh yeah, it's not so good. But we didn't have a lot of time to waste. We only had 4 days, five days. So yeah.
Right. So were there... Did you have nerves going into such a short and regimented series of days in the studio? Like... Were there moments where you were like, oh, I'm not sure if this one is done, and you ended up having to live with it? Or do you feel like you started out with a really clear plan and you got every single, checkbox checked?
It was, I wasn't scared because I've done it before with Joe quite a few times, maybe a dozen times. And I've made my last 2 records like that. I made Great Lakes like that as well. Having worked with Joe, I just decided that's the way to work. Play something 3 or 4 times. If you haven't got it, move on. And why would you spend 10 days in a studio when you could pay for 4 and go on a holiday, you know? So I'm used to that discipline.
Yeah.
I think I had a plan in my head, but then as soon as you get in the studio, things start happening and people start playing and plans change and go out the window. So somewhere between those two things, it came together. And that's down to Joe and his sort of command of the environment, which I think if you ask anyone will work with him, no one quite knows how he does it, what he's doing, and no one can really see him doing it. But he does something because his records all sound like Joe productions, and he encourages people.
Yeah.
He made me sing in ways on tape that I've never sung before. I think that's been a...
What's an example of that? Like, what's a vocal performance that like really surprised you on this record?
The song Silver Mine, which is a heavy song and a bit swampy when I listen back to it. You know, in the cold light of day, I think, God, that is a bit, there's not a lot of levity in that song, but I sang my brains out, and I've never sung like that on a record before.
Yeah.
I was really singing from very deep within myself, and to hear that back kind of blew me away. So I've been really trying to, I've managed to do it live before. So I've just been trying to lean into that, just really.
Yeah, that's a special performance.
That song. Thank you.
Speaking of the kind of guts stuff that is on this new album, I would love to hear about the inspiration behind The World Turns and the songwriting process. And also just like having seen you perform, I'm curious if it's ever challenging to share such a personal slice of life publicly on stage.
Well, I think I decided around the album Headlong that I would ignore those feelings, basically, because singing really personally and sort of writing about my own experience and singing it in a way that is more accessible has sort of changed my career. It's moved me from a more obscure sort of myth-obsessed folk act that I was right up until sort of 2014. Into a more slightly commercial leaning, certainly more accessible singer-songwriter. And with that has come, a better living and a sort of a much more, more of a sense of warmth from the audiences. So I haven't questioned it. Anytime I've written something where I've thought, God, this is really personal, I'll play it to my wife.
Right.
And I say, is this too much? And there's only been once or twice where she said, yeah, I think that is too much. But, you know, when I was singing about all the things that she had been through and my mother went through during the pandemic, there were moments where I thought, God, is this too much? And she just went, no, you know what?
Yeah.
Sing it. And I did. And then people were writing to me saying, hey, man, thanks for that. My wife had a miscarriage. That song got us through it. Thank you. And then I kind of went, well, holy cow, you know, that is amazing and it's happened again, like singing about my dad's Alzheimer's, people writing to me saying, I look after my mum, she's got Alzheimer's, whatever it is, you know, and people can relate mm-hmm. to it. So it's, there are moments where I feel a bit sort of like I'm cringing a bit, like, it's not very in keeping with my character to talk about what's happening in my very personal life with strangers. But
right.
I mean, it sort of resonates with people differently to mm-hmm. to how sort of singing about mermaids, you know.
Are you intentional about, like, aside from just singing about your family and health struggles and loss, like, are there personal details that you're conscious of holding back in your, like, introductions and, like, your banter, I guess?
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of levity required for people to sit through an hour and a half of music. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to bog them down with all the heavy details. And I felt that when I sort of read it back in my, you know, bio that the journalist wrote about this record, it all just seemed a bit too thick. So I'm sort of happy for the songs to do the talking and then between the songs for me to just sort of mess around. And going back, I didn't answer your question about The World Turns, but that is, mm-hmm. that song is loaded with the sort of feeling that so many of us had of coming out of a really difficult time during pandemic, for whatever reason. So many people had so much mm-hmm. to deal with, and trying to move on and accepting that the world keeps turning, and all you can really do is cleave to those that you love and those that you need, and stick your chin out and just get on with it as best you can. And if I were to go on stage and say all of that, there'd be people going, I feel people would then be, it might just be rubbing it in their face a bit, but I think people come to a show to escape some of the harshness of reality, and I don't necessarily want to talk too much about it between every song. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's an art to it. It's really, it's interesting to see how, like, you can love a record and then you see the person perform it live. And there's such a stagecraft, and each artist does it so differently. Like, some people really love to, like, dig into little literary details down to the finer point. But yeah, there is, like, a levity to the way that you introduce the song. So I was curious about the thought process behind that.
Yeah, I think perhaps I used to talk a little more about the meaning of each song. But I think with that came a certain amount of guardedness. And a couple of my really close girlfriends said to me recently, will you stop going on stage and being John Smith and go on stage and just be John?
Mm.
And it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I went, yeah, all right, that's possibly the best feedback I could have moving in. This was at the start of this campaign, like 6 months ago, when I was starting to play the songs live. And I went, yeah, okay, I'm going to leave the sort of fabricated persona of that I've sort of invented it as a way of keeping a barrier between myself and some of the nutters in the audience. Just, you know, a little bit of 6 feet, stay over there, I'm not going to let you know who I am. And I realize actually all I'm doing is limiting myself with that to an extent. So I'm trying now just to go on stage and be me. If I feel especially good about a show, it really works. And if I'm feeling down about a show, then it's really hard, because and then you have to dig in and go, okay, I'm going to put on a bit of front here to get through this. But in general, it's been serving me pretty well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I hope that makes sense. Yeah.
Oh, it does. Yeah. I think a lot about the masking that we do to, like,
masking, that's a good word for it,
protect ourselves socially and to communicate what we want to communicate without having our whole personal selves on the line every single time.
Yeah.
But there's risks to being authentic, and there's risks to being guarded. So I think it's a really interesting perspective. It sounds like your female friends have a perspective on, like, what is happening when you seem more authentic versus what's happening when it seems more performative.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I listen to the women in my life, and it serves me very well. You know, I sort of,
it's good.
I don't know what else to say. If I'm playing a song and my wife goes, yeah, that's not great, she's always right. And if I'm playing something and it's really cooking and she loves it, that song tends to do pretty well. I, you know, there's some magic there. I obey it. When I was writing The Living Kind, the title track, she burst into the room and started dancing around. The song almost didn't get written because I was in full flow. And then she was like, oh, sorry, I'll leave you alone. Shut the door, went away. And then I finished writing it, you know. And she was like, have you written it? Great, that's the best song ever. And it's a highlight of the whole set now.
Yeah, so, it really is. Yeah. People like get going. Milestones is a really special song on this record. Yeah. It's about physical markers of change, internal growth, you know, seeing your daughter grow up and also seeing yourself change in response. And it was super cool to see you play it in so many different cities around the UK. That line about finding some bright corner of England really stands out to me. And it makes me wonder, how has your relationship to home and your home country changed since you've become a parent?
So it's an interesting one for me, given where I'm from, which is sort of lots of places. I was born in one place, I was raised in another place, I fled that place as soon as I could and lived out my young manhood somewhere else, and then I met my wife and I lived in other places. I'm from England, but I don't hold a massive sense of identity with any one part of it. Mm-hmm. I've just been a drifter really my whole life. I've lived in 30 different houses in my life. And I just, part of having a child has been the desire to put down roots, but it's only, she's seven now, and it's taken us this long to figure out where we're going to do that.
Right.
So I feel that line about some bright corner of England is perhaps a sort of something in my mind's eye of something I'll never achieve because the government have made it impossible to get an affordable mortgage for a larger property. And I think maybe that bright corner of England is somewhere in the countryside. But as a working musician, I've learned in the last few years that really I need to be nearer to an airport. I need to be nearer to London. So I think maybe what am I trying to say? I think that song is just about the desire to every now and again be still and really appreciate family. Because especially before COVID, in the year that my daughter was turning 3 years old, I did 130 shows, you know, 200 days on the road. I was really going for it, Lizzie. I thought this is the year I'm going to make it. And then COVID happened and everything went away. And so that forced me to reconsider. And now I'm looking for opportunities to stay at home rather than to go and get on a plane. That's been the big one. And now we are about to finally put down roots in the Southwest and settle because the upheaval of the last few years has moved us around a lot. That song, I stopped singing it on the last couple of nights of the tour because it's of all the songs, it's the one that gets me the most. It's the one that I feel the most self-conscious about because I'm really singing about some of my failings as a father and some of my, some of my sort of failings as a, I suppose my perceived failings of myself as an adult and as someone who provides for their family. And I had to make quite a conscious decision to include that one on the record. But fortunately, it's a really nice guitar part, so that really helped. I really dig playing it.
Yeah, I think it's a very special moment of vulnerability in the set. But I can't let you go without talking about guitar parts and arrangements. What is it like for you to take an album like The Living Kind, which has some percussion, harmonies, like so many different arrangement elements, and turn it into the one-man show that you take on the road? Like, how do you figure out how to prioritize what sounds need to make it into the live show when you're just one person?
Well, a lot of Joe's ethos around recording this album was to have my voice and my right hand front and center. So a lot of what happens on the record is about elements kind of drifting into view and then moving out stage right, mm-hmm. you know, you sort of see, you see things dance on and dance off. So there, at the center of it is me and my guitar. So it was just a decision about, well, which songs need a little bit of help to sort of expand the sonic palette. So I did a lot of research last year about different effects that I could bring in to sort of swell at different points. I've really been into guitar pedals for a while, but I sort of mm-hmm. took it to a different level with sort of MIDI samples and triggers. And there are songs where, you know, a little bit of a sort of guitar swell that I pre-recorded will come in for a second and disappear. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted it to be a little more expansive than it's been previously. But as always, one of the considerations is budget, you know? It's,
yeah,
everything is twice as expensive and half the people are coming out. And so to take a band on the road would have been prohibitive, really, for this tour. Mm-hmm. So I just thought, well, if I'm going to do this solo, now's the time. This is the most difficult time to go on the road. I have to prove to myself that I can do this. If I'm going to last another 10 years, this is it. I've got to do it. So that was part of it. It was kind of a challenge for myself. It would have been kind of easy taking a band on the road. I wouldn't have made any money, but at least sonically it would have been taken care of. And I never do things the easy way. That's a bit of a fault, I suppose. But I never go easy on myself.
Yeah, we're going to need to actually include some photos of your stage setup when we release this episode, because it really bears inspection. I think some of the interviews that you've done, like with, was it Premier Guitar, like being able to share what goes into like putting these soundscapes together when you're just literally one person on stage, that for me is like one of the most interesting parts of seeing this record go from a recording to a full live show.
Yeah, cool. Thank you.
We are on the Basic Folk podcast, so we need to talk about genre. In 2019, you released Hummingbird, which you described as like your first attempt at a bona fide folk record, even though you are in some ways already... you've always been a folk artist, but Hummingbird you've described as like, that's my folk record. So in your opinion, what makes a folk record? What inspired that project at that time? And do you feel when you're making something that is like described as a folk record, do you feel a responsibility to a tradition, even though it's your work? If that question makes sense, like, do you feel like you owe the genre and the tradition certain responsibilities?
No, absolutely. So I suppose there are three things at play there. The first is the idea of a folk record, quote in quotes, is in the UK that means something more traditional leaning in the sort of British folk lineage. And I have always felt that I was very fortunate early on to tour with Davy Graham, John Martin, John Renbourn, the greats of the acoustic guitar, and I'm hardcore into Richard Thompson and Nick Drake. And I saw myself being part of that lineage, though that sounds quite lofty when it's coming out of my mouth.
No, we get it. And John Renbourn would agree. He's on record saying he agrees.
He's very kind, yeah. So I felt actually that is something that I want to lean into in a much more specific way, rather than just bearing the influence. I want to go out and record some traditional songs, choose some material that Nick Jones or John Renbourn might have chosen, and make my fist of it. And then there's the timing of it. My management company had just disbanded just as Headlong was released. So the big commercial record that I'd put out in the hope to crack the charts and get to America and everything. The company folded and I was found rudderless and without management, completely broke and terrified. So I found myself at Folk Alliance. I was playing a series of those hotel room shows, you know, playing to three or four people. I played a bluegrass situation room. I met Amy for the first time. And I played some other room to maybe four people. One of those people was David Macias at 30 Tigers.
Wow.
I walked out of the room. He collared me in the corridor. And within 2 minutes, he was talking about how we were going to structure a deal. And I found myself, it was all totally unreal. And I said, sure, man, you know, this sounds great. I knew him a little bit already because I'd done the transatlantic sessions with Patty Griffin, right. And he'd been there at the back of the bus with his laptop working really hard. I just thought he was really impressive. So I get home, a contract lands, I'm on 30 Tigers, and they say, why don't you make that folk record you've been talking about? Mm-hmm. And so I did, and it felt great. I did it with Sam Lakeman, mm-hmm. who is husband of Cara Dillon, who is one of the great Irish folk singers. And I'd toured with Cara back in the day, and I'd learned a lot about traditional folk music touring with her and Sam. So I had this collection of material that was, some of it was traditional. There was a cover on there. There were a couple of original songs. And it occurred to me, like, I could either go ahead and make a very traditional sounding record, mm-hmm. or I can just play these songs as I want to play them. And there was, that's as far as the conversation went. So there was only one decision to be made.
Yeah.
And that, because I feel that though tradition is, it's fun and it's nice to look at, you can't go out and, I can't go out and hold true to a tradition that inherently contains restrictions, because then you're just on stage doing something that someone else wants you to do. Mm-hmm. So it seems pointless to me. So I just went out and played, I sang those songs as I sort of hear them in my head. I put some traditional instrumentation around it, but mostly it's, you know, there's a fiddle, there's a little bit of whistle, but it's guitar, bass, you know, some mm-hmm. other vocals. It's still kind of one of my records. I just, the thing I love about those songs like Lord Franklin that are 300 years old, they've just come down through time and they still affect people, mm-hmm. you know. They're just great songs. So I just thought, I'm going to treat this almost as a covers record. I'm just going to interpret these songs as I would.
Right.
And so almost tradition be damned, because I just don't believe that I'm the right person to uphold those traditions. Other people are, for sure, but not me. It feels like then I'm just going to have to play guitar a certain way and sing a certain way and sing about, oh, the jolly lads and all that stuff. Use words that no one uses anymore. It doesn't work for me.
Yeah, you want it to be in this time and place.
For sure, yeah.
Okay, before I let you go, I know I'm conscious of your time. Will you do a lightning round? It's just a few quick shoot from the hip questions.
Yes.
Great, okay. John Smith, lightning round on basic folk. If you could choose a superpower, what would it be?
I would like to be able to eat gluten.
Mm-hmm.
I would eat pizzas after shows.
That's a very grown-up superpower. What was the last live show you attended that made you say, wow?
Oh, it was my now friend, Julian Large.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know him when I saw him. He blew my tiny mind. And I can honestly say that he is the nicest guitar player working today.
Oh, that's nice.
He's a sweetheart.
What is the best time of day to write a song?
Goodness, I think that's whenever the song decides it wants to be written. Mm. I can get up at 4 in the morning and start writing, and by breakfast I've got nothing. So I've given up on that. I just, whenever a song comes along, I'll mm-hmm. sit down, and it can be any time.
What is a snack that you cannot live without in the tour van?
Well, as you witnessed, I'm rather partial to a bit of beef jerky. Mm-hmm.
Solid. Proteinous.
Yeah, I think it's that. Yeah, proteinite.
Who is your favorite guitar player working right now?
I think it's still Bill Frisell.
Cool.
When I hear him, he just transports me, takes me far away.
And what is one song you wish you had written?
Goodness me. I would love to write something like Amelia by mm-hmm. Joni, though I could never sing that particular song.
But that's the magic of the lightning round.
There it is. Let's say Vincent Black Lightning by Richard Thompson.
Okay, those are both great answers. Thank you so much for joining me on Basic Folk. It really has been a treat to dig into your work.
It's such a pleasure. I hope I didn't waffle on too much.
Oh no, this is perfect. You could have waffled on for many more hours.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can check us out on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. Go to our website, basicfolk.com, or you can find us wherever you get podcasts.
Send this episode of Basic Folk to a redheaded friend or a friend who is an ally to redheads.
Thank you, Lizzie. All right. We will talk to you next time. Thank you for listening once again. Bye.
Bye.